Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I want to thank this committee for inviting me. This is a wonderful place to come up on top of the mountain. It's my privilege to be standing up here tonight. I attended the first roundup up here about 5 years ago. Came up to learn a little bit more about this program, never dreaming that I'd be invited up here to share with you what I have tonight. And I want to thank you. You might as well get your handkerchiefs out. Because we're going to laugh and we're going to cry, and it's real good. It's real good. My name is Louise, and I am powerless over alcohol. And by the grace of God, and you people, you wonderful people, I haven't had to take a drink. I haven't had to take a drink today, nor have I had to take a drink since September the 9th of 1962. A lot of wonderful things have happened to me since that date. I don't take credit for any of them. I take full credit for the things that happened to me before. I'm a big book person. In fact, I moved into the Memphis area from Washington, D.C. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in Washington, D.C. And I moved to Memphis in 1966. And everywhere I went, I carried the big book. And they nicknamed me Billy Sunday. But you know, I never did have too many arguments, because if they started arguing, I just opened a big book and we got right in. And out of the human nerve a little bit, and I am going to strictly talk to these new people tonight. And I'm so glad to see them up here for their first trip. And out of the human nerve a little bit about how AA works, you'll have to know a little bit about what it had to work with. And this is what the big book says. We share a little bit about what we used to be like and what happened and what we're like now. I can remember in a big courtroom, much larger than this. I was a little girl and I was sitting on the front seat. My legs wouldn't even touch the floor, and I had on long cotton stockings and little high-top shoes. And I was sitting on that seat, swinging my legs, and I looked over across this big room, and there was my father. And right behind me was my mother, and it was a judge up on the bench. And I looked up, and I didn't know what was going on. I didn't understand what was going on. And I looked over, and I wanted to go over and crawl up my father's lap and hug him, and I wanted him to hug me, and I wasn't allowed to do this. And the judge looked down at me and he says, "You go with your mother and your brother go with your father." Now, friends, I want to tell you something right now. It's not what happened to me. This has happened to many people. It's not what happened to me. It's the way I reacted to what happened to me. The way I reacted. My mother and father was getting a divorce, and my mother got custody of me, and I was placed in a convent. I have nothing against the Catholic religion, dear friends. I have nothing against the Catholic religion. I was raised in the convent. My daughter's a convert, and she married a Catholic boy, and I have two grandsons that are Catholics. But I was placed in this convent away from the people that I loved. This was all that I'm certainly sure my mother knew to do at that time. But right here was a turning point in my life. You know, I was made to kneel down on a concrete floor and pray. And I did not know to whom I was praying. All I can remember was being told what God would do to me when I did something wrong. I had a perfect vision of the devil. I had pictures shown to me of the devil, but I never had anyone to show me a picture of God. And I was never told in this convent that God was a kind, loving, forgiving God. I only remember that if you do something wrong, you will be punished. Now, I came up under this way of life, and a lot of people adjusted to it. But I want to tell you what started going on inside of me. I remember my mother coming to visit me one time, and she said, how are you? And I said, I'm afraid. What are you afraid of? I don't know. I don't know what I'm afraid of. She says, you're too big to be afraid. And the very next time that she came to see me, she says, how are you? And I said, fine. She said, are you afraid? And I said, no, I begin to lie. Immediately with the fears that was inside of me, I began to lie. Oh, and I see little children, you know, they're so afraid you're going to whip them for something they've done that they'll lie to you. And this was the beginning of my life, and this was the beginning of my life. With my fears, untruth came into my life. I came out of the convent a teenager. My mother had remarried, and she had married a very well-to-do man, and he was a wonderful man, I'm certainly sure. I was taken to a home, and I was given everything a child could be given materially. My mother was a domineering woman, and my mother allowed me to be intelligent, but she did not allow me to be emotional. I was not allowed to cry. I was not allowed to show any emotions. She wanted me to be this and that, and she tried to make me be these things. And immediately I rebelled because, you see, somewhere along the way in this convent, I began to hate this woman. And, dear friends, this hate went all through my life, and this hate almost destroyed me. I began to hate her, and I was afraid, and I didn't like what I saw because I didn't understand anything. And I began to rebel, and I was still taught about all of the things that I was allowed to do and all of the things that I was not allowed to do. I was taught so many things that were not true. And, you know, I'm certainly sure that they didn't know any better. But this was frustrating, and I remember very well one time not understanding all of this, and I looked up in the heavens, and I shook my fist up at God, and I said, what do you want me to do? I don't understand what they're wanting me to do. Now, I never felt love, because I'll tell you, in through all of this frustration and the trials and all the tribulations and my early life, I heard something that destroyed me. I heard my mother and her lawyer and quite a number of people discussing this, and I heard her say, I did not want her to begin with. Now, what does this do to a child? What does this do to a child? Well, that lump came into the middle of my being, and it was there until I had my last drink of alcohol. Never did it leave me, never. I was destined to become addicted to some type of drug. This I know today. I know this. The first man came along. Boy, I tell you, I wanted to get away from this thing. I was incapable of love. I had closed myself up. I had built a shell around myself, and I was incapable of love. You know, to love another human being, you take a chance of being hurt. And I wasn't about to be hurt. I had had all the hurt I wanted. But this man came along, and this was a good while ago, and a lot of you in this room don't understand it, but back in those days, you could only go riding on Sunday afternoon. This was a long time ago. They did have cars, T models. But this man came into my life, and I remember out riding one Sunday afternoon, I made some cute little remark. You know, these women are born. These men have to acquire, but these women, God gives us this when we come into this world. You know, we can just turn these men on, and we can just get anything we want. All we got to do is shed a few tears, and they just melt right away. And I was doing something, you know, real cute, and this man said, now, if we were married, you wouldn't do that. And I said, when? This was in February, and we were married in November, and my mother had a beautiful wedding. My mother had a beautiful wedding. I remember walking down the church aisle in this long gown, and I remember nothing else other than I had on a pair of pure silk hose. They didn't have nylon then. And pure silk hose ran if you looked at them. And I was only interested in not getting a hole in those pure silk hose. And I knew I was going to have to kneel all through that service. Because, you see, my mother was a Methodist. I was raised and educated in a Catholic convent. And this boy I was marrying, we married in a Presbyterian church. And if that don't screw you up, nothing will. And we kneeled through this wedding, and I remember thinking, if I don't like it, I can get out. That's all I thought. That's all I thought. This marriage was destined to fail because I was so incapable. A lovely little girl was born of this marriage, though. And I don't remember even drinking back. I know for a period of 10 years, alcohol was not even in our home. Now, I had had a beer, I'm certainly sure, when 3-2 came out. Because, you see, I never wanted to be different. I always wanted to be a part of. And when the girls went out behind part of the school building and rolled a cigarette, I went with them, and I smoked some of the cigarette. And I was being part of the group, and I was being accepted, and this is what I wanted. But immediately, I always felt guilty because I had done something wrong. And the guilt began to eat on me. Well, you know, in drinking the beer, I'm certainly sure that the guilt came in at that time. Beer, whatever it was, it didn't do anything for me because, friends, I had too much going on inside of me. Now, alcohol did not enter my life at this early age. And as I say, for a period of 10 years, I do not remember. My husband was a career man, and his goal, he had set this goal, and he was going to stick with it, and he did. And he was a very stable man, and this was his life. Well, we moved and moved, and finally we moved into a different area, complete new surroundings, and it took me away from my surroundings. It took me away from the place where I was born and raised and everyone knew me. And we moved to a new state, and I was alone, and I had this child, and I had dearly, dearly loved this child. I had given her all the love that I felt I had never received, and I almost destroyed this child, and I don't know but what today that I have damaged this child. But we moved into this new area, and here we became active in civic affairs, and this is when I was introduced to cocktail drinking and social drinking. And we were out at a club one night, and we were dancing. And I never will forget, this was a little turning point in my life, because here is when I began to use the alcohol. We were on the dance floor, and this man and his wife were dancing. They were real good friends of ours. And my husband and myself were dancing, and we danced by this man and his wife. And he looked over his wife's shoulder, and he winked at me. And you know, it felt so good because someone had noticed me that I just winked back. And you know, immediately I felt I had done something wrong because this was against the standards that I had been given to live by. And I felt guilty and I justified it. I said, oh, I did that because I was drinking. And this was just the beginning. Just the beginning. And I learned real fast because alcohol is a good teacher. Alcohol was so necessary in my life, friends. Alcohol is the only reason that I'm alive today. I have no qualms against alcohol. Alcohol literally kept me alive. Because, you see, I know what I was doing. I know with my thinking, friends, I was committing suicide mentally all through my life. You see, this thing was inside of me long before I had a drink. It stayed inside of me long after I was drinking. Never did alcohol relieve this feeling. In my worst stages, I would cry out, why? Why am I here? Why? And never, never could I get relief from that hurt. Well, alcohol became important, and our social life became important, and my husband was growing in his profession, and this little girl was in high school, and you know how the old rat race begins. Alcohol came into my life at this time, and I'm certainly sure that it was necessary You see, I had a thinking problem long before I had a drinking problem. Long before I had the drinking problem. Well, our marriage was destined to fail, and it did. You know, going into a marriage like that, it could not last, and it was destined to fail. We were separated, dear friends, in 1946. My husband went into the Washington area. He was transferred there, and I stayed down in Mississippi. And I was going to put this little girl in college down there, and he lowered the boom on me, and he said, you either bring her to the state of Virginia and put her in college, or I will cut off all funds. Well, you know, with a heavy heart, I loaded this child up, and I moved to Virginia for her. Well, that's a lie. I moved there for me because, you see, I was afraid. I was afraid not to. I did not want to lose the security of this man. I did not want to lose this man's security. I had to hold on to that. That's why I would never divorce him. I went to the lawyer, and we had everything. All I had to do was pick up the divorce, and I could never pick it up because I did not want to lose this security. This was all I had. The hate for my mother was so great, I wanted no part of her. So I moved this child to Virginia, and I moved her because I had to. I put her in school, and I began to change. Now, my life began to change. I went into the District of Columbia, and I got a job, and I had no qualifications. But I was real, real lucky, and you know, we alcoholics are real lucky sometimes. We just step into things, and it just happens. I worked for this company, and it led to me to many, many great things. In fact, in a few years, I was able to own my own company. I went into the wholesale jobbing business, and this was a rough business for a woman. And I know that this destroyed something within me because I put myself on the level of a man. And you know, God didn't intend for a woman to be on this level. And dear friends, we're not supposed to be on the level of a man. But I got in there and I fought, and it destroyed something within me. It took away something. It took away something from me. Because, you see, I was fighting right along with the man. I always thought I was equal to the man. I wanted to prove something. I was always setting out to prove something. I don't know. I wonder if I was trying to prove something to my mother. I don't know. But I always was trying to prove something. Maybe to be accepted and be wanted. I don't know. But I went into this field, and it grew, and it grew, and my drinking grew and grew, and it became necessary one day for me to drink. I had crossed over the line into alcoholism. It's an invisible line, and I did not know anything about it. I had the disease of alcoholism, and I drank because I had to drink. Alcohol was necessary for me then. You know, many a time I'd go into a bar, and I'd order a drink at 5:30 in the afternoon, and I would say, I'm going home and take care of my responsibilities. And I fully intended to go home and take care of my responsibilities. And I would have one drink not knowing that I was an alcoholic or I had this disease. And you know, after that one drink, I still had the responsibilities, but I could not go home and take care of them. I could not. I wanted to, but I could not. I had to have another drink. I still had the responsibilities, and I would say after another drink, I'll go home and take care of these. And I could not. I was powerless over alcohol. After the drink, I had a drunk. I did not know this. And I would come to sometime at 2:00 in the morning, still in this bar, and I would say, I wonder why I couldn't get home and take care of those responsibilities. I did not know I was sick. But about this time, I began to make the hospitals. And I can tell you, if you have money, dear friends, you can go to the nicest hospitals. You can make all of the nice, plush, drying-out places. And you can come out and you will have absolutely everything that you want. They always wrote on my admittance, suffering from dehydration and malnutrition. Never, never alcohol. Never alcohol. I remember that I had an office in New York and I had an office in Washington, and the alcohol was becoming so important in my life that I knew that I couldn't handle these things. Now, I did not want to admit this. Who wants to admit that they are not capable? And I did not want to admit this. So I started conning myself. I started selling myself. I started justifying things. I said, you know, I'd better relinquish some of this business and get out of a little bit of it before something happens. I did not know that I was getting sicker and sicker and sicker. But I relinquished my office in New York, and I moved into Washington only. I had 75 men employed under me at one time. You know, this is hard to run a business when you're drinking. Eventually, I had to move my office into my apartment because I could not commute back and forth in the mornings. It was just too hard. I justified fighting the traffic. Well, I had hangovers and I was sick. I was having to entertain and be entertained. And it was a sick way of life. And I just said, well, I'll give up this office and move into my home. Now, here is another turning point, because when I moved my office into my apartment, I went to my desk in the morning with a fit. And you just don't do much business. You just don't do much business like this. I would have sales meetings and I'd tell my people, for goodness sakes, don't pad orders. Don't cheat. Don't steal. It's not worth it. And as I began to relinquish a lot of these salesmen and a lot of these lines, I began to steal. And I began to cheat. And I began to do all the things that I didn't want to do. And pretty soon I would go in the hospital and come out and I'd fight this thing and I'd go back in the hospital and I came out. And the only thing I can tell you out of a lot of these hospital trips, I made some good connections. Because a lot of our government officials right up there in Washington, D.C. was in the same hospital. I came out of there and I said to myself one morning, something's wrong. Something's real wrong. Something's real wrong. I called my doctor. I had a doctor right there in Alexandria, and he put me in this hospital under a very, very good psychiatrist. Now, this psychiatrist was a very well-known man, and he was good. And I stayed under him for about 6 weeks, and I came out of the hospital, and I was going back for sessions with him. And one day, I had gone into the district and parked my car in front of a liquor store. Now, liquor stores are all over the District of Columbia, so you don't have any trouble finding one to park in front of. But I had parked there, and this was so strange. I went into this doctor's office, and he said, Ms. Aldridge, I'm very sorry. I'm going to have to discharge you. I cannot help you anymore. He said, every question I ask you, you answer it with a question. See, I was lying to this man. I did not want this man to know what was eating me up inside. I did not want this man to know what was going on inside of me. Well, when he discharged me and I was paying him $75 an hour, I didn't like that. I didn't think anybody you know would discharge you. They're getting your money. And I walked out, and as I went to get in my car, I saw this liquor store. And I walked in, and I remember ordering the fifth of my favorite brand. And when I went to get it, perspiration was pouring out of the palm of my hand. The mental obsession was so great. The mental obsession was so great for that drink. I got in my car, and I went over to the Mayflower Hotel and checked in. I had no one in my apartment to feed me, and I thought, well, I'll check in the hotel and take care of a few of my accounts here. And I'll have a chance to order up food, you know. And I'll never forget going into the room with my bottle. I kicked off my shoes. I turned on the television. I ordered up ice. And you know that first drink that you get after you haven't had one for a long time? Some of you know what it is. You know, you pour it over ice. You know, you begin real nice, ladylike. And I poured it over this ice, and I reared back, and I had a drink. And it, oh, it felt so good. It tingled all over as it went down. And I remember that I was looking at the television program, and the next thing I knew, it was 4 days later, and I came to in that room. I had not eaten a bite. I had drank around the clock, and I was in a puddle of blood. I was hemorrhaging, and I was real sick, and I didn't know what to do. I called a girlfriend that worked upon the hill, and she took leave and came over and checked me out of this hotel and took me to my apartment. Oh, this was one of the biggest turning points in my life, because as this girl was waiting for them to bring my car down, she looked at me and she says, my God, Louise, why don't you try AA? You've tried everything else. Well, now here I am, real sick, real sick. I did not remember her saying this for a long time later. She got me over in my apartment and she scrambled me 2 eggs and tried to get them down me. Well, you know how it is. Trying to eat 2 scrambled eggs, had a man drunk that long. But she left me, and I went to the phone, and I thought about this mother down here in Arkansas. And I said to myself, I'll call this woman and go down and see her. And I did. I got my mother on the phone, and I thought, if I can just go down there and this woman can put her arms around me, I'll be all right. I knew now that I was sick, but I just didn't know what it was. I didn't understand this thing. And I was talking to my mother, and I asked her if I could come home. And about that time, the telephone clicked, and I heard her scream out at the operator, "Don't disconnect me. My child is sick. My child is sick." Well, you know, I hung up the phone, and this little daughter of ours had married, finished college, and married and was living over in Maryland. And I called her, and you know, she didn't want any more to do with her mother. She had come to many hospitals to see her mother. She had come up there and seen me and my insanity, and she wanted no more of this. So she just picked up the phone and called my doctor in a matter of a few minutes. He was in my apartment. And that day I was committed to a mental institution in the state of Virginia. Now, I'll tell you, friends, they took me over there, and they locked me up on the third floor. They put me in the room with a mattress on the floor and bars on the window, because, you know, this hospital did not know what to do with a drunk. They did not know what to do for drunks. It was a mental institution, and all they could do was put me in this room until I came off of this drunk. And you know how a drunk will scream and holler because every gut inside of you is hurting and you want something to relieve this thing. And I'm certainly sure I was doing the same thing, and they left me in there. And this was my first convulsion. Now, you know, after you have a few of them, you don't mind them so bad, because then you begin to know when they're coming. I came out of that room, and I stayed locked up on the third floor for 3 months. And this was one hell. This was one hell, I'll tell you. When an alcoholic gets a little dry, you know, they become a little sane, and they understand what's going on around them. Well, you know, these mental patients don't do this. They don't understand what's going on around them. And I remember I went over to the door, the window one day, and I grabbed a hold of the bars, and I shook them, and I looked up in the heavens at this God, and I said, if there's such a thing as God, and I'm going to have to stay here, let me be like these people. Let me be like them, and thank God he doesn't answer you or prayers all the time. Because I got out of this hospital after 8 months. I came home to this apartment, and I closed myself up because I hated the world. I hated you. I hated everybody. I wanted nothing to do with the world. You had done this to me. You had put me there, and I didn't want anything to do with you. So I locked myself up, and I wanted no communication with the outside world. Now, I didn't drink. I didn't think of a drink. I don't know why. I was just so sick mentally, I just don't know why. But I stayed locked up in this place, in this apartment, for 3 weeks. 3 weeks. And one day, this is your same thinking. One day I said to myself, nobody cares about me. And I just got in my car and went over to the District of Columbia and got a case of booze. And I had to come back through the state of Maryland to get it across the river into my apartment. And this is where I lived in hell for 3 solid months, drinking around the clock for 3 solid months. I could get the booze brought to me by the cab. I never had to go out for anything else. My blinds stayed pulled. I had a pair of old pedal pushers that I never took off for 3 solid months. I lived in my own world. If you don't think an alcoholic is a selfish, self-centered person, they will live in their own hell, and I did. I wanted nothing to do with the human race. I was doing what I wanted to do. I was so insane that I would turn on the television, and whatever came on the television, I was that. You know, if it was an opera singer, I'd get up on back of the couch and sing a little. I would look at television through one eye, and I was whatever I wanted to be. And this was a wonderful way of life for me because I was doing what I wanted to do. This was a sickness. This was a sickness. And I remember around 11 or 12 o'clock at night, a sports announcer came on, and I knew nothing about the sports. I couldn't keep up with them. But I noticed this announcer was a real good-looking man. And you know, I would sit there, and I'd look at him with one eye, and I finally conned myself into saying, you know, this man needs to know me. I said, you know, he just ought to see how pretty I am. Couldn't dress, you know, anything, but I was real good looking. This is the insanity. But, you know, I struggled around there, and I kept watching this man, and I don't even know who he was. I know his part of his name was Michael. But anyway, I went to the telephone and I tried to call Michael because I thought he ought to know me, you know. And you just don't get through to these announcers that easy. But this was just one of the insane things because I would live to see him come on. You see, I was living in my own little world. Well, one day, friends, I'll tell you, alcohol will let you down. And if you don't believe me, and if you haven't had enough, if you will stick with it, it will let you down. I assure you. You cannot get your oblivion. You cannot get what you're seeking out of it. Because one day this happened to me. This happened to me. I was paralyzed. I could not function my legs. I could not manipulate my legs at all. And I was blind. I had had DTs and I had had convulsions in this apartment. I knew what they were because I had tried to come off of this booze and I couldn't. The insanity was so great. And I would go right on back and I would drink and drink and drink. And this day I could not get what I was searching for. I could not get oblivion. My mind seemed to get clearer and clearer and clearer. And you know, it was frightening. It was frightening. I would try to get this oblivion because now I knew whether it was, I didn't know whether it was day or night. It made no difference to me, the time. But this wouldn't come to me. It wouldn't come. The more I drank, the clearer my mind became. I'm crawling on my dining room between my living room and kitchen on my dining room floor, and there, right in the middle of the door, is when I cried out. And I'll never forget that night. Because I was so desperate. And I cried out, God help me. Very simple, God help me. I didn't understand God. I didn't know any part of God. But this is all I could do. And I said, God help me. Now, you know, I had asked him in this mental institution and he didn't do anything for me. But God heard me tonight. He heard me then because, you see, I was sincere at that moment. And I was sick. Because in a matter of a few minutes, an hour, I have no recollection. But the two letters that this girl had mentioned a year and a half before, AA, came to my mind. Now, I could not dial a number. I could not look in a phone book. I could not see. But I crawled over the telephone, and I dialed operator. And eventually, she put me in touch with Alcoholics Anonymous in Northern Virginia. And a girl, it was after 8 o'clock at night because I found this out later, a girl answered the phone, and this was a strange thing. And you call them coincidence? Uh-uh. The meeting's up there at 8:30, and this girl had happened to go by the intergroup office to pick up some literature because she had a new baby with her. And this girl took my call because men work the office up there at night. And this girl, it was not what she said. It wasn't the words she used, it was the tone she used. The tone, and then I knew someone understood. I felt that someone understood. I had a feeling in here that someone understood. And this girl says, you know, we do this one day at a time. One day at a time. Can you go to bed and not take another drink tonight? Do you know, dear friends, for the first time in all those months, I said yes. My bedrooms were upstairs, and I had not been able to get up there. I had not been able to take off these pedal pushers. I crawled up those steps that night, and I crawled into my bed. Early the very next morning, this girl called me, and she said, can you go without a drink? And I said, no. I said, I know what'll happen to me, because, you see, I could feel the sickness come down the back of my spine, and I knew what would happen. And I told her no, and she said, just take a little bit, and I'll be right over. And that girl walked into my apartment, and she didn't say, where is your husband, how much money you've got, or anything. She says, we can help you. We can help you. And she stayed with me, and they took me to meetings around the clock. And they nursed me, and they stayed right with me for 4 solid weeks. 4 solid weeks. And one afternoon, after I had some of the AA members had gotten out of my car, we had been somewhere to see someone, and it was around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and the mental obsession was so great inside of me for a drink. I couldn't stand this knot that was eating my insides out. And the obsession, the mental obsession was so great for me to have a drink to get a little bit of oblivion of all the things that they had said in these meetings and all the things they had offered. I did not understand them. You see, I had a closed mind. I was incapable, dear friends, of letting them love me. I was incapable of letting them help me. I walked into an ABC store in Virginia, and I picked up a bottle. And I never will forget, I went out in my car, and the obsession was so powerful and so great. And I know what this thing is. I know how you feel when you have to have a drink. Because I lay down in the front seat of my car and poured the whiskey in the corner of my mouth to get a drink of it. The insanity there was so powerful. Oh, the obsession was so great. The mental obsession was so great. And then the physical compulsion came in. And dear friends, I stayed in hell for 8 solid months. 8 solid months I lived that way. I would try to get off a drunk and come back to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I'd walk in and I'd sit on the back row and I didn't want to hear anything about your God. You see what I had gone through, I didn't want anything to do with God. I was afraid of God. The only God I knew was a cruel, punishing, unforgiving God, and I wanted no part of this. And I would sit on the back row, and when they got ready to say the Lord's Prayer, I'd get up and leave. I wanted no part of that. I would go out and I'd drink again. But if some of you in this room tonight, and I hate to say this, but it's so true, that's going to drink again. And it's not necessary. But it's there. It's the mental sickness that we have that's coupled with a physical allergy. I know that I went to some meetings and I heard some good ways to drink. And if you're not through drinking, you stick around and we'll show you some good ways to drink. Now, if you want to get off of the hard 100% bourbon, well, you can always switch to beer. And then if you want to go on to something a little more pleasant, you can go to wine. And if you haven't tried it, I'd advise you to try it if you want to drink some more. Because, you see, you won't have to worry about this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You won't have to worry about having a spiritual awakening. You'll be in one all the time. You won't be able to move. You'll sit there and you grin. Don't you? And you know, the most beautiful thing, you talk to yourself. But it's not what you say to yourself. It's the answers you get that are so powerful. And you live in a whole nother world. And I'm telling you, friends, I learned this in AA. So stick around and we'll teach you a few things. It's not necessary. But I tried this. And oh, my goodness gracious, you haven't shook off a drunk yet. You just shake off a good old wine drunk. You don't sweat. Oh, my, you're so sick. You're so sick. But you see, I had to try all of these things because I did not want you to know me. I did not want to know me myself. I did not want to know me myself. I could not know me. I could not let anyone inside of me. I came off of the wine, and I went to a meeting, and I saw a tall, gray-headed, good-looking man standing back there at the coffee pot. And I went home and I started on a little beer. And I thought about that man and I said to myself, you know, I'm going to call Buster. And I did. And I said, Buster, I'm lonely. Buster was in Blackstone when I told Liz about him and he remembered it. I said, Buster, I'm lonely. He says, you're drinking. I said, yeah. I said, why don't you come out and see me? I knew they made 12-step calls, you know. And you know, Buster came out and he brought a new pigeon with him that was jumping and shaking so bad. And Buster was, he came into my living room with this new little boy and his name was Larry and I just hated his guts. And he brought him in and you know, little Larry celebrates his birthday 1 month before I do. He said, honey, after seeing you, I never want any more of that stuff. And I did not know Buster had 14 years sobriety. And he said to me, get your clothes on, honey. We're going to a meeting. And I went, and this was good. This was good. I tried. Keep coming back. Because on the ninth day of September of 1962, I'm standing out in my backyard shaking off a drunk. I'd also heard in a meeting one night that a hot beer, if you opened it the night before, was a good thing to sober up on. And I'm trying it. I had a hot beer and I'm trying it. And I'm shaking and I'm hurting. Oh, the loneliness and the hurt. It's just no way, unless you walk this walk, you can't talk this talk. Because it hurts so bad and you don't understand. I'm shaking this drunk off and something happened to me. The turning point of my life. I say that it was the moment of truth because standing there in that backyard that day, I stripped Louise absolutely naked and I looked at me. And I knew right then, Louise, you never have to take another drink as long as you live if you don't want. For the first time I saw me for what I really was. For the first time I was able to open up just a little bit, and surrender. Surrender. And you know, the most beautiful thing happened to me because at this very moment, I believed what you people had told me in meetings. I believed you. And I survived with just that. Because I began to say to myself, I believe. And this is all that kept me alive. All that kept me alive. I went to a meeting that night and I came and I sat on the front row. And I wanted what these people had and I didn't know how to get it, but I wanted it. Something had happened in my life. I know what had happened now. And you do too. But I looked at the speaker. I don't know what he said, but I had a feeling, you know. It's a communication from heart to heart. It's like the little sister up in Canada said, it's arrows that penetrate from one alcoholic to another, and they're so deep, and on that arrow is written love. And for the first time, I was able to let love come into me. And dear friends, until you can open up and let love come into you, you are suffering. I never will forget my sponsor, Robbie Robinson, that is dead, and I'm certainly sure it's some people in this room that knew Robbie. He was sitting on the front row, and he said, come on, Louise, and have a seat. This is incurable, old honey, but you'll hardly feel it. And I sat down there by Robbie, and he carried me, and he taught me many things. He told me many things that I must do. He told me the things that I must not do. And I had the pleasure of having Robbie open a home up in Alexandria, Virginia, for the alcoholic woman. And I'll tell you, it was one of the greatest experiences I ever experienced. And it helped me learn a little bit about you. Now, this program of Alcoholics Anonymous consists of 12 steps. And it is a program. And, dear friends, I had such a closed mind and such a closed heart that it was so hard for me to get into the program. I was 6 months sober, and I was put in the hospital, and I was told I had another incurable disease. And I was told that we would have to fight this thing, and the doctors could not tell me what the outcome would be. But this was a physical thing. This was a tangible thing, and I wasn't afraid of this. You know, we're not afraid of a tangible thing, something we can see. It was the things that were intangible that I did not understand that were so frightening to me. I was in the hospital for the next 2.5 years. I went under many treatments. And I never one time was really afraid of this thing. Because, you see, I had found something in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some strength, but I didn't understand it. I'm 3.5 years sober, and they had told me, Louise, you've got to take this program and live it. You must take this program and live it. And I could not get any further than I was. I could not understand God. And I knew that I had to break this down. I knew I had to find this God that you all talked about. I'm 3.5 years sober, and the insanity was returning within my life. I did not want to drink, but I was thinking about suicide. Now, I knew that death would be much better than a drunk. And I had told myself that I will take my life if I cannot understand this and get rid of this lump that was eating me up inside. I called my doctor. I had learned enough. I said to myself, I will try something else. I had read Norman Vincent Peale, Billy Graham, Emmett Fox, everything. I had been to see priests, preachers, and ministers all over the country. I could not understand God. You see, everything you were telling me was beautiful for you, but not for me, because you were telling me about your God. I called a farm, a drunk farm up in Pennsylvania, chit-chat. I wanted to go in there and commit myself and see if maybe I could find something there. I was searching everywhere. I could not find it. I called my doctor. I said, put me in the hospital. Run a reevaluation on this disease and see what's eating me up, because I cannot live. I knew that I would kill myself. I went in the hospital and I stayed a week, and I came out with amazing, amazing. This doctor would look at my reports and he says, these are miracles, these are miracles. And I didn't understand them. And I went back to my little apartment and I'm sitting there on the couch. And dear friends, this happened to me. And I want to share it with you because it's so very important. I'm sitting on this couch and outside of my window, all of a sudden, I see me. Outside of myself, I saw me. And this woman walked up to this window and she looked in at me and she says, my, my, Louise, how much you have to be grateful for. I was 46 years old, friends, and I had never experienced the emotion gratitude. I had never been grateful for anything in my life. Everything I had gotten, I deserved. You owed it to me. And for the first time in my life, I understood what gratitude was. And as I slid off of my sofa, ready to fall down on my knees and pray, the flashback of my childhood and what I had always told myself, I'll never pray again on my knees, because that concrete floor came up in front of my face. And as I went to bend down on my knee, I said, but Louise, you're kneeling with your heart. And I knelt down on that floor. Now, friends, I'm not going to tell you I jumped right up and I was a different woman. No, but something happened to me. For the first time, you see, I was able, really, to look outside of myself. I knew that I was no better or no worse. I knew that I was no more or no less. I knew that I had limitations. I knew that all of these things that had happened in my life, I knew they had happened for reasons. Now, you know, I began to talk to my God, and I talked to him just like I talked to you. And it's just so comforting, because we have many talks, and I need him so bad many times. Now, there are many times, too, dear friends, that I lose communication with God, and this happens to all of us. But you see, today I understand this. You know, in this spiritual thing that happened within me, I was able to forgive my mother. I was able to forgive the judge. I was able to forgive my father for not ever coming around me and letting me love him. I was able to forgive myself, because, you see, I knew then that God forgave me. And, dear friends, I want you to know, you're making yourself bigger than God if you don't think God can forgive you. God can forgive you for anything. God forgave me for everything, and in turn, I was able to forgive myself. I was able to forgive this woman because I knew that God had forgiven her. I knew this woman had shortcomings, and I did not allow this. I did not allow this woman to have shortcomings. I had put her on a pedestal. She was an idol, and she shouldn't have made mistakes. And then I had to see that this woman was capable of mistakes and the things that she did to me. She thought at the time, I'm certainly sure she was doing wrong. I wasn't able to go to this woman. I wasn't able to go and tell her how I felt. But I'm certainly sure tonight that she knows. You see, I buried my mother before I was able to find this. I was only 2 years sober in this program when I buried my mother. But let me tell you, friends, I buried my sister. She was 39 years old. She died in an alcoholic convulsion on the streets in Chicago. And if you don't think that this alcoholism is a killer disease, you stick around and you watch it. It's a killer disease. I was burying my sister at the same time Tom Lovren was burying Dutch Whitley. Dutch Whitley was sober, and I was burying my sister the same day. and she had died drunk, 39 years old. Dear friends, this is a way of life. But you know, it is a program, and we must take this and apply it to our life and live it. And today, I must do this. I had separated from this husband in 1946, and you think they're a coincidence? No, they're not coincidence. I moved to Memphis, Tennessee to make amends to this child. I felt I was strong enough. I felt that I could come down here and maybe talk to this child or maybe show this child something, because you see, this child was afraid of me. And I moved to Memphis, and her father had moved here before me. And he was living with this child. And they went out and they tried to help me find an apartment. And it just wasn't one to be had. And all of a sudden, and if you don't think that this is a strange thing, because God works in strange ways. Because they're helping me find an apartment and I couldn't find it. And all of a sudden, my daughter says, "Mother, why don't you buy a house?" And in a matter of an hour, I had bought a house, and I turned to my husband and I said, "Would you like to share this home with me?" And he said, "Yes." And we bought this home together. And he wasn't in this home a week till I noticed that this man was sick. And I said to this girl, "Your father is sick." And she said, "Mother, he's been sick. He's senile. He's been living alone so long, he's real sick." And he was. You see, this man needed me, and I didn't know it. I didn't know it. And this man has been sick ever since. But you see, he needed me, and this is the way God planned it. God had me there when I was needed. And this man says, "Oh, I wanted you." And I had never felt wanted in all my life. And this little girl, she began to understand a little bit. The fear began to go out of her voice. And she would call me on the phone and she would say in a panic, "Mother." She didn't know for sure about her mother. And that was in April when I moved there. And in October, I went over to this child's house and I walked in with a little birthday present. And I walked up to this child and I said, "Happy birthday, Betty." And for the first time in all those years, she walked up to me and put her arms around me and kissed me on the cheek and said, "Thank you, Mother." And if you don't think that this program pays off, it certainly does. And it's a way of life. And if we take our time, it will pay off. I have a wonderful life. I have my ups and downs. And this child is sick, and I don't know how much damage she has. Because this just this past January, she came down with a blood clot in her arm. She was in the hospital and under heavy sedation, and they were trying to thin her blood down. And she jumped on her mother. And you know something, God has given me a lot of strength, because if it had been any other time, I could not have taken it. Because this child accused me of all of her heartaches and all of her problems. And I looked there at my little girl laying in that bed and I said, "Dear heart, if this is the way you think," I said, "this is something I can do nothing about." I said, "You know, Betty, you must find your way of life too." But I said, "If this can justify it and give you a little relief," I said, "you do this." I said, "you can accuse Mother." And I walked out of that room and I went home and I went into my bedroom and I prayed and I said, "God, I must cut the cord from this child. I've done all I can do." And you know, for a little while, I had no communication with God. And I'm telling you this because this can happen to you. You know, we do lose a little communication because of our emotions. We are human. And for a little while, I had no conscious contact with God. And I was afraid, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And I did not panic, because I knew that if I would just give myself a little chance, things would come back, things would happen. And they did. Dear friends, do not panic when these things happen in our life, because these are normal things. I was able to survive this. My child has not said another word about this, but I heard her the other day say to her father, "The priest is coming to visit me." She has called and asked for help. You see, dear friends, this is a way of life. But they told me you must change your thinking to change your entire life. Louise had to change her thinking to change her life. I'm going to close with this wonderful thing that I think expresses AA better than anything in the world. This man one Sunday morning was reading the newspaper, and his little boy came up and tugged on his arm. And he pulled on his father's arm, and he said, "Father, you promised to play with me today." And the father said, "Oh, son, run on. I want to read the paper." He said, "Run on. I want to read this paper." And the little boy said, "Oh, but you promised. You promised." And the man looked down, and there was a picture of a map of the world. And he looked over there, and he said, "Well, I tell you, son, I'm going to take this picture, the map of the world, and cut it up into little pieces. And you put it back together. Daddy will be through reading the paper. And I'll play with you." And the man cut the picture, the map of the world, up in little bitty pieces and gave it to his son, and he sat down on the floor to put it back together. And just a matter of a few seconds, the little boy was up, tugging on his daddy's arm, and he said, "Daddy, I'm through." And the father said, "Son, you couldn't have put the map of the world back together that quick." And the little boy said, "Oh, no, Daddy. On the other side of the map of the world was a picture of a man, and I put him back together. And that's AA. It put me back together, and the world's all right. Now I can let you love me. Now I can love you in return. And as long as I can raise my right hand to God and put my left hand on the shoulder of a drunk, I don't have a third hand to take a drink with. Thank you."